everyone. So good to reconnect with you all. See your beautiful smiling faces. I've missed you, and I've been looking forward to reconnecting and our continued conversation about Lojong practice. I was just hearing about your session last week with Anila, whom I've known for many years, met through our teacher, Kempo Pema Wangduk. So really pleased that she could be with you to talk through the sixth point. And tonight, we'll continue. I'll move into the seventh point of this practice. And there are quite a few pithy teachings in this point, so we won't be able to get to them all, but we'll do our best to jump in at least to the first half. And then to also bring in just some awareness of how to work with these spiritual teachings clinically, because there's such a psychological treasure chest here. And I'm aware that you're all in various mentoring roles. So we'll think through how to reap the spiritual benefits of these teachings, but also how to be applying them, working with them in our various mentoring roles. So maybe as a starting point, what I learned from Kempo Pema about this part of mind training or Lojong practice is that it's really meant as a way to bring your spirituality actively into your life, to try to integrate what you're learning, you're reflecting upon, so that it begins to mix with every experience. And so that sense of your spiritual life being something discrete, something separate from your professional life, your romantic life, your academic life, your economic life is no longer the case. And the method traditionally with this practice is memorization, which I'm not very good at, but I can really appreciate the benefit. Because the idea with these pithy teachings is that if we spend enough time, of course, thinking about the insight of the various aspects, the nuances of each pithy teaching that is encapsulated or symbolized by this phrase, then we'll have it at our ready when we most need it. And I have really found this to be so. I mean, the teachings that I've been able to memorize have been extraordinarily useful over time. So for instance, I've had experiences with moments of indecision. Should I pursue this possibility or that possibility? My friend says, go with possibility A. My brother says, go with possibility B, and then I'm caught in a state of indecision. And then there's the pithy teaching of the two judges rely on the principal one, meaning trust yourself, trust your own Buddha nature, trust your own intuition. That's just one example. And the last time I was with you, we were discussing driving all blames into one. It's another super handy teaching when it really feels like the other person is going to drive us crazy, right? The decay of Western civilization is gonna cause our decompensation, which might be in the mix, but driving all blames into one can be so helpful when it feels like we're gonna go down a rabbit hole of what someone else seems to be doing. So that's the method, is to really, really take your time with these teachings, potentially memorize the ones that you can, all of them, if you're able to, so that you've got something right deep in your mind, deeply woven into your psyche that's available to you. So we'll start with the first teaching, practice all yogas as one. And I love Joe's translation, the art of compassionate openness. So the way I've come to understand this is, of course, we have many, many teachings that we're working with in the Dharma. We also have a number of lineages, and in each lineage, there are lots of methods. Right? So some of you come from Soto Zen tradition, some of you come from Theravadan background, you probably come from all of the Tibetan lineages, and we've got quite a diversity of methods. And at times that can get a little confusing. I've heard students over the years ask, for good reason, how should I practice? You know, there are the proverbial 84,000 teachings, there are all these methods, there's mindfulness, there's visualization, there's breath work, what do I do? So with this teaching, practice all yogas as one, it's a reminder that regardless of the method we're working with, the challenge, the spiritual challenge, is to keep cultivating that bodhicitta, right? To keep working on that felt sense that our spirituality is completely grounded in other people's realities and experience and needs. Yeah, so this is the orientation to keep revisiting. And I would say this is probably a particularly helpful and I would say necessary teaching in non-Buddhist countries and Western cultures where people might be coming to the Dharma later in life, where it can feel like our spiritual practice, our spiritual healing is for our own well-being. And it's not that we can't include, of course we have to include our own well-being in this endeavor. But the Dharma is really after what it's like to understand that we are, by our very nature, intimately in connection with all other beings. It doesn't seem to feel that way. Often it feels like our own, you know, our own struggles, our own needs are surely of ultimate importance. And that everyone else theoretically is important, but really when you get down to it is more of a distraction to the reality of these pressing personal needs to work through our traumas, our, you know, our chronic neuroses, our difficulties. So in a way, this practice all yogas as one is saying, if you really want to feel freed up from distress, anxiety, suffering, then please orient this entire endeavor, right, toward bodhicitta, that wish to be fully awake, on board with reality for the benefit of all. And to continue grounding your practice and the well-being of others. Yeah. Practice all yogas as one. I've also learned this one as practice all yogas with one intention, to again to reinforce just that central intentionality of perhaps starting by noticing how you might not feel so intimately in connection with others, especially people you don't personally know and people who have caused you problems, people who have been unkind to you, people who don't seem to understand you or care about you. Often it's with these people that we feel that fundamental, impenetrable sense of difference. Right. And so it's really a long-term practice to start to understand how porous our psyches are and how we really do co-create one another. Yeah. So taking that orientation of cultivating bodhicitta, or an awakened heart and mind for the benefit of all, and then linking it to the next teaching, to subdue all resistance with one, and taking care and giving love on the breath. This is really such a psychologically brilliant teaching, because in a way it's saying, or at least this is one way that I come to it, we can be less phobic about pain and suffering. We really have an opportunity with the Dharma to normalize suffering, right? It is part of the human condition to struggle and to get lost and perhaps distorted understandings of our experience or other people's experience. And rather than building a life around those distortions, which will generate yet more suffering, we can practice opening the mind, right? Practice becoming a little more comfortable with suffering, not to inflame it or to exacerbate it, but to really trust in our capacity to safely feel it more fully. Yeah. And this is a clinical gold mine, because often when people have been badly hurt, it's very easy to become phobic about suffering and to feel that it is impossible to live meaningfully. It is impossible to feel good about oneself. It's impossible to call meaning from life if you're suffering. And so all sorts of protective defenses can be cultivated in response. But this teaching is saying, by nature of being human, you will encounter suffering. You'll encounter your own suffering. And I don't need to belabor the point. We're 9 months into a pandemic, at least in the United States. It's just been an extraordinarily distressing time, and we have not all suffered in the same way, but I have a pretty good idea that we have all suffered. And probably we've all suffered with just tremendous disbelief about the way things unfolded, about the lack of empathy for those who are really shouldering the burden of the pandemic. You name it, so many examples of suffering that we've been living through. So in this teaching, it says, it's okay, we can actually work with that suffering. And I know you've been exploring this throughout your studies, but we can use our various practices like Tonglen, like giving and taking, where we become less worried about being harmed by suffering, and we actually use it to nurture our compassion, to let ourselves taste the suffering a little bit more, or get a little more understanding of what's in it, be willing to metabolize it more, reflect on it more, not have to circumvent it, bypass it, defend against it, so that we really feel that wish to respond to suffering skillfully. Right? And that's a key point, right? There's the arising, you know, of compassion in response to suffering, but then there's the question of how we're going to respond, what we're going to do, how we're going to work with it. So subdue all resistance with one art, taking care and giving love on the breath, right? That we can use suffering as fodder for our compassion practice. And this is such a relief, right? This really can be such an enormous relief, so that in a way, those defenses against suffering are no longer needed in the same way. Right? If we really accept we are going to suffer and we can work with that to become more sensitive people, people who are willing to learn more about the causes and conditions of suffering, then we can nurture our trust that there is meaning that can be culled from suffering. Yeah. Okay. Feel free to stop me at any point if there's a something that needs to be clarified. But in the spirit of getting to a few more of these, because they're just so rich, I'm going to move to the next one. At the start and finish of each day, do the two actions. Now, I really love this teaching because it can sometimes feel as though we're trying to knit together a life by nature of navigating each day and navigating the difficulties, the challenges, the stressors that we encounter in each day. And perhaps you have noticed in the last several months or 9 months that as the stress has increased and as the suffering has increased, it's very tempting to wake up and almost in that monkeyian scream state and wonder how are you going to get through the day? How are you going to survive this madness? How are you going to tolerate the deprivation? Let alone cultivating bodhicitta. And that can just start to feel like such a, if not a lofty goal, somehow not entirely relevant when you're dealing with acute suffering. So this teaching, at the start and the finish of each day, do the two actions. It's saying, please care for yourself by bringing your awareness to bodhicitta, to that potential for an alert, awake, caring mind and heart, right at the beginning, right as you're transitioning into consciousness after having been in your dream state. Take a few moments. And sometimes it's lovely to do this before you get out of bed, right? Because sometimes once you're out of bed, that's it. The race is on. You got 16 critical things you must tend to, or you've got 16 difficult experiences that are really vying for your attention. So this teaching is saying, help yourself out right at the beginning. And you can use your creativity. I'm all for using language that helps you feel authentically in connection to this teaching. May this day usher in deepening awareness for the benefit of all. May I open my mind and my heart to reality as it unfolds in a way that reduces suffering and increases well-being, however you want to articulate it. That it can be so helpful to take a little bit of time before especially secular reality seems to take over. Yeah. Now, as a part of that, it describes two actions. There's also the suggestion to, at the end of the day, reflect a little bit on what your experience was like. Right? Were there experiences of suffering that you can be aware of and perhaps set the intention to more fully explore in the spirit of understanding the suffering and working with it skillfully? Or, you know, were you feeling really engaged in a meaningful way? And is that something that you could just reflect upon? To basically lift to awareness or to increased awareness, how you have been in your life, how you have been in this world throughout the course of a day. Now, it sounds like such a benign teaching, but actually it's a radical suggestion. I mean, it occurs to me now that it's a lofty goal to just get out of bed, right? I mean, things have been fairly rough, so it could feel like, I'm gonna try to get out of bed, and then at night, I'm gonna try to find something to watch. If you haven't watched all the shows, there was that Roz Chass cartoon that I love. So a woman sitting at the table and she says, I've watched all the shows. I've read all the books. Now I'm watching my bananas. Maybe I'll make banana bread. You know, it's been a little intense, this pandemic. So this seemingly benign teaching is saying, okay, great. Shoot for getting out of bed, but maybe add to that endeavor some habituated awareness that you're going to work with your mind. You're going to work with your heart. You're going to try to access your most precious resources, whatever happens. And then at night, just to check in with yourself, how did it go? Right? What happened? Is there any residue? You know, is there anything that's swirling around you or haunting you or distressing you that you'd like to non-judgmentally acknowledge and then revisit, you know, when the time is right to begin to work it through? Yeah. Okay. So, moving on to the next teaching, tolerate both good and bad, whatever comes. This is another gem, right? This is really the key because we're talking about patience here. And it's one of the six skillful means, right? Tolerate both the good and the bad, whatever comes. And this is just a through line in mind training and Lojong practice and in Shanti Deva's work. Basically to suggest we lack the power to prevent difficulties, to prevent experiences that might be very challenging to navigate. And again, boy, are we living in a time where that's extremely obvious, right? It almost, the Dharma has never been more obvious, at least in my lifetime, as it is now, right? This is just reality. It's not what we anticipated, but it is the reality. And so this teaching is saying, please again, help yourself and help others by cultivating more patience, by cultivating the capacity to tolerate reality with all of its unexpected twists and turns, all of its unexpected losses, all of its unexpected experiences that may feel and are quite unjust, all of its experiences that might leave us doubting, you know, whether or not life can be meaningful and joyful. It's saying that the most important capacity we have is patience, is tolerance. And Kenpo Pema often says, Buddhists love to talk about compassion, they love to talk about peace, but there is no compassion, right? We're not able to sustain peace of mind without patience. Peace of mind is the very first thing to go out the window if we don't have that capacity to tolerate our difficulties. Now, as clinicians, we want to be careful here, just as human beings, but certainly clinically, we want to be careful so that it doesn't sound like this is an instruction to keep an even keel and don't have intense feelings about painful experience or unjust experience. The Dharma is not saying that, although it's easily misinterpreted to suggest that, you know, we should stay in a relatively neutral affective range. But really what it's saying is strong feelings will come up. There's, you know, if you're letting yourself be impacted by life, a whole lot of affect will get stirred. The question is, what do we do with it? So that we're not just getting tossed about in a way that leaves us feeling like a wreck. And this is, of course, a lifelong endeavor of how to feel our affect strongly, powerfully, authentically, but without becoming reactive as a result or enacting these feelings in ways that just wreak havoc or cause more suffering for ourselves and others. So it's saying, look, please just understand, you know, life probably will be tumultuous. And we cannot prevent ourselves from losing the conditions that seem to generate our happiness, right? So if we can work with our own internal capacity to really hold reality more fully, then we're gonna have that ballast, that internal ballast that will help us. It'll help us get out of bed eventually, even if we know getting out of bed means we're gonna deal with something difficult, right? And it also will help us enter into the joyful experiences more fully, right? This is really an invitation to not deaden oneself. It's an invitation to allow ourselves to meet reality, to meet life as fully as we can, you know, but to find that containing function within ourselves. Yeah. Tolerate both good and bad, whatever comes. Okay. Now, lastly, I'll say before I move on to the next one that I think inherent in this teaching is the notion that we don't want to just survive suffering. And this is another important clinical point because many people are really quite burdened with the fear that they will merely survive, especially if someone has been through quite complex trauma and maybe many layers of trauma, so developmental trauma, as well as an accident, as well as collective trauma, right? The more complex it becomes, often the more burdensome that fear becomes, that the best I can do is survive. But the Dharma is really after how to transform our minds through our experience. It's almost alchemical, right? How to let our minds intersect with our experience with such depth and such integrity that we're no longer in that reactive state. We're just letting ourselves work with our life. Yeah. So it's not just about survival, it's really about transformation. But for most of us, it's a long-term process with a lot of trial and error. Okay. So pretty soon I'm gonna pause because I would love to hear from you, but just briefly, I wanna get to the next few points because they're really so important. The next one is guard both these and your other pledges as your life. It's quite dramatic, isn't it? Guard both these and your other pledges as your life. There are a lot of ways to understand this teaching, but it's really saying we have the capacity to let our life be oriented toward well-being, toward healing. We really can do that. Even if we have been badly traumatized. And now this is where meaning is made, right? This is why it's so important for people who have had extremely complex suffering to work with it, right? To tell the story, to do something that allows other people to learn more about it, to let it foster more intimacy with others rather than more alienation. So in this teaching, it's saying, please understand how sacred these teachings are. It's not just about stress reduction, although that's good, I'm all for it. It's not just about having more focus and being more productive as a result. These are critically important teachings around understanding that we have remarkable internal resources. I mean, the psyche, it is the most profound technology that I know of. We just need roadmaps. We need methods so that we can work with the psyche in order to reduce, I would say, first understand and then reduce multiple forms of suffering and help people claim their own internal resources. But we have to really first have some feel for how sacred these teachings are before there'd be any real incentive to guard them with your life. Yeah. Okay. Now, these next are so, so rich, but at least we're gonna get to this next one before I pause to hear from you. Master the three hardest challenges, and this is a beautiful translation, Joe, to expose, ameliorate, and eliminate blocks to an open heart and mind. One way that I learned this teaching is to first recognize the emotions that we have difficulty with, right? Recognize our conflicting emotions, which are typically described in the Dharma as some combination of desire, jealousy, anger, greed, I don't know, pride, ignorance. That's the general basket of the difficult emotions. And this one is saying, in order to master these difficult parts of our experience, we first have to recognize them. We first have to expose them, lift them to awareness. And of course, in our mindfulness practice, this is a central part of what we're doing. We're having a close look at what we're experiencing in the mind and in the heart. And we're learning to lift it to awareness with as little judgment as possible, right? Because the more judgment we have, the more we're inclined to feel terribly ashamed about the pride, the ignorance, the envy, et cetera, et cetera. And so it might feel too treacherous to even recognize. So the mindfulness process, the non-judgmental awareness, really helps with lifting to recognition these difficult experiences. And of course, we really cannot work with our internal maelstrom of feelings unless they are lifted to awareness sufficiently, right? Otherwise, what happens is we enact it either through compulsivity or through repetitive interpersonal dynamics that we just find ourselves caught in again and again, or through our dream life that is carrying the burden of trying to work through feelings that we're struggling to lift to awareness. So it's saying, first recognize these difficulties. And then, I mean, the way I learned this, and I just appreciate how Joe works with this, I had been taught to then try to manage these difficult emotions, which I have to admit, as a clinician, and as at that time when I was a child, I was not yet a clinician, but I think I was a clinician in waiting. And so it always rankled me a little bit to hear these teachings on managing the emotions. I could see the value, and I still see the value, because we need a containing function. That's not the same thing as repression or suppression. Right? I mean, the skillful parents here, you work so hard to contain, to help your children when they are flooded with difficult affect, when they hate you, right? When they are riddled with terror. Part of the challenge is to both join them, but then not join them fully, so that you can bring your resources to contain, so that they feel a little more supported in the experience. And so I would say, you know, rather than managing the emotion, it is about learning to be in relationship more consciously with our conflictual or our difficult emotions, so that we have the containment of reflection, right? And patients will often ask me, well, what's the difference between reflecting and ruminating? It's a huge difference, right? Rumination indicates that someone is caught. They're caught in an obsessive revisitation of some experience or some feeling. But reflection has a lot of spaciousness to it. I would say when people are reflective, they're connecting with Buddha nature. They're connecting with the part of the psyche that can really have a pretty expansive, receptive, and curious look at even the most shadowy part of our experience. Yeah. So that's ameliorating or managing. And then eliminating the difficult emotions, that's a very interesting question. I mean, and this could just be a projection of where I am developmentally, but it seems to me that we are by our nature affective creatures, right? We are human by nature of our capacity to feel and to feel deeply and to feel an incredibly broad spectrum of feelings. So I don't know if we need to eliminate these difficult emotions, because to my mind, they are empty too. They're dynamic, they're arisings. But the question is how to really reduce the response to these emotions that will generate pain and suffering. Yeah. And this is a big part of what we do clinically, right? Because often when people come into treatment, and this is a bit of a generalization, but I would say it's generally true, either they're prone to being flooded by difficult emotions, or they're inclined to defend against them through a variety of protective defenses so that they're not sufficiently feeling the emotions. And so part of what we're learning in the Dharma is how to allow, right? If it's desire, how to allow for it. If it's anger, how to allow for it, but also how to support that arising with a reflective containing function so that we're not so vulnerable to drowning in it, to being flooded by it, nor are we as vulnerable to having to evacuate it onto someone else, right? Projecting it onto someone else, and then very likely distorting our perception of the person who's received our projection. Yeah. So I'd love to say a few more words about a couple of other pithy teachings, but I do also want to pause there just to see how this is sounding. See if you have any questions, reflections. And if you have your hand up and I can't see you, please feel free to just shout out.
Pilar, I have a question. So thank you for your teachings again. I was just wondering if you could speak more to, I think you said how we co-create one another and maybe how that is relevant to the point or the phrase that it was being mentioned with in a little more detail.
Yeah. Well, you know, the default position, right, that is described with such beauty in the Dharma is a feeling of being fundamentally, concretely separate from others. Right, feeling a sense of impenetrable difference, being in a different body, having an interiority that cannot be shared, right, cannot be known, cannot be understood. And as a result of that perception, so many of us will feel quite a bit of alienation and anxiety and paranoia, you name it. I mean, all of the difficult emotions have something to do with that sense of not being able to find you, right? And also not being able to be found by another. And so by co-create, what I mean is that, I mean, the reality is, and it really isn't conceptual. It can feel a little conceptual. It might feel fuzzy at times when you're hearing these teachings, but the reality is everything about us is relational, right? Our brain chemistry, and now we have all this marvelous data that backs us up, right? Our bodies, our nervous systems, our psyches, our digestive system, I mean, obviously the air we breathe, everything about our experience is actively created by others. And by extension, we are actively creating other people's experience. Yeah. So in this way, we co-create each other. And this is true from the beginning of life, right? Where some babies will feel found or feel sufficiently found, so that their sense of themselves starts to evolve in accordance with who they authentically are by nature of how their caregivers reflect who this person is and who they're becoming. Others will not feel found or sufficiently found, and therefore will start to cultivate often false beliefs about who they are, that there's something about them that prevents others from getting close, right? There's something about them that's inherently unrecognizable, right? Because we are so relational, we do create every aspect of each other's reality. So in terms of the, which teaching did I, do you recall?
Yeah, I think it was,
Sorry.
I think the first one.
The first one, yes. Practice all yogas as one, yes. Yeah, so the teaching of bodhicitta, right? The reason why this is relevant is because it can be tempting if we're not feeling authentically in connection with others, then all of our healing efforts can seem to be for our own benefit exclusively. Because how could they be for anyone else's benefit? If I'm not intimately in connection with anybody else, if I can't be known, if I can't be loved, if I can't be understood, or I don't know how to love, I don't know how to understand, then the Dharma is so that I can be less of a fruitcake, or I can suffer less anxiety or less depression, right? But the Dharma is entirely about deeply challenging that delusion of separateness, which is why we're encouraged to ground. This is why we dedicate our practice at the end of each practice, whatever you do, we dedicate it to others because it is for everybody, right? And it's so that when we walk outside, there's a little more awareness that, oh, I'm in this human family, right? We're all trying to get out of bed. We're all staring at the bananas, having read all the books, watched all the shows, rather than, you know, I'm the one, as Bob says, I'm the one who's read all the books and is now going to lose her mind. And therefore, I'm going to need some resources to hang in there. But these spiritual resources are to really understand we are relational, right?
Laura, I think there's an irony in terms of your commentary, because we were just talking about Ani Santan's presentation last week. And one of the things that I found very striking about her presentation is, like, she had the completely opposite, was saying, you know, realize, don't you really have to realize and start with the understanding that we're all fundamentally alone? And she was really talking about it, about this practice from the standpoint of each of us has to kind of work on our own mind in this way. And you're both students of the same teacher. So go figure. You have to explain that to us, how you got a completely different take.
She was saying we're all fundamentally alone. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Well, I wonder if she meant, and I don't obviously don't know, but I wonder if she meant we're all fundamentally responsible for our experience. And in that way, we're gonna have to work with our own minds. We're gonna, right, rather than feeling that someone else is gonna have to carry me along, we are gonna have to practice a kind of supreme personal accountability.
You did it.
That's my guess. I mean, that is Kempo Pema's very powerful, ever-present teaching, right? Because of course he comes from a community of Tibetan refugees, all people who have very severe, complicated trauma histories, you know, all people who lost multiple family members, often the entire family of origin in the refugee camps, and were separated from any loved one at a very young age. So, you know, these were not teachers who've had much privilege. And so Anila and I have gotten very, very powerful teachings that we really are responsible for working with our suffering. And it's critically important to not, you know, to not indulge the feeling that other people are responsible for it. Other people must in some way shape up and start treating us like the Queen of England, or else we're always going to be miserable. I mean, I would prefer it if people treated me like the Queen of England, but Kempo Pema would say, don't hold your breath. And know that it's your choice. And this is a teaching he gives a lot. Listen, you know, you can use your suffering to be miserable, or you can use your suffering to really deepen your intelligence, your skillfulness, your capacity for patience, your capacity for joy. But it is your challenge, it is your work. Yeah. Was there another question or comment?
Pilar.
Yes.
I was just thinking that it can feel scary to step out with that type of responsibility, because maybe in our daily world, we think there are all of these sort of real rules that keep us, you know, on track and alive and keep everything functioning. And to think that all of it is so relative, and that we can actually change it with just a shift in our focus and our attention, can feel like, wow, that's so fragile. And so I'm kind of curious, and like, I guess you could think that there's a strength that someone must develop in order to, you know, have the wisdom and the ability to discern, and even the right, you know, aspiration or the right intention. And, you know, how do you recommend people go about building a structure to, you know, strengthen these kind of areas in their regular life as regular human beings in a regular world, in a regular pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Anne. I mean, in a way, Lojong, it's just meant to be a reliable roadmap, a method, so that you have some tools while you're cultivating, you know, the capacity to discern, to be skillful, to open to your reality. You know, I'm just looking at this next list of teachings, right? Don't be erratic, learn decisively, investigate and analyze, don't indulge frustration. I mean, it's pretty specific. And it's these teachings, I think, are trying to help us out so that we can have what we need and to dispel some of the mystery, right? Because, I mean, there's a reason why, and it's, I think this is going to come up in one of these teachings, we're encouraged to study, but also to practice. And in one of these, it might be on the special cases. It says, yeah, study, but practice is more important than understanding. You know, just keep practicing, keep memorizing these pithy teachings. Keep at your breath work so that you're able to just keep bringing it out into your life more and more. Yeah. Does that answer your question, Anne, or did you have an example?
I think that answers my question. I guess the only follow-up would be that there are so many different places to look and work on. So how do you recommend people get started?
Well, I mean, the mind training process has a really lovely map, right? It's of daily practice, daily bodhicitta prayer, daily refuge prayer, and then spending a little bit of time contemplating some of the pithy teachings so that we start to internalize them more. Because that's the challenge, right? Is to take the Dharma out of the conceptual realm and let it really get a little baked into the psyche, so that when we're in the midst of crisis, right? You know, your beloved is suddenly critically ill and maybe has been misdiagnosed, and now things are looking dire. I mean, we deal with all sorts of crises recently that seem to change the course of a life. But if we're really internalizing these teachings, then we're going to have some resources. It's something that can carry us, right? So that we're able to navigate even extraordinary difficulties, you know, with some sense of some integrity, you know, some sense that we're going to have the capacity to, again, I would say, call meaning from it. Yeah.
I love what you're saying, and I think this is a great question, and my take is that this teaching is a very, very sort of unusual, exceptional kind of blend of extreme rigor, yeah, and extreme accessibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I almost think of it as, you know, giving every person a little flavor for what it's like to be a Buddhist monk or a nun and have that level of discipline about your reflection. Mm-hmm. But all the practice really asks you to do is just read the words.
That's right.
You know what I mean? That's the practice, is that you just read it. Just read this every day. And you'll see things, it will change you. So in a sense, it seems like a really tall order and really hard to kind of like, how am I ever going to do any of this? But it's really not asking us to do that much. It's trusting in our natural Buddhahood that with a little bit of, you know, salt and pepper of this kind of these provocative statements, something is going to come out of us, you know, where it's going to be a meal, you know.
Sorry to interrupt, Joe. Could I also clarify a little bit to people that might not understand? When you say, Pilar, stay with the breath practice, so we're talking about the Tonglen, right? We're talking about, as you had recited in one of the points, the taking care and giving love. So we're talking about that specific practice, because that is like a set of training wheels, right, for when the shit hits the fan in real life, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that's a really accessible practice that can radically change your experience, right? It can break through the feelings of isolation, right? It can help you feel like you've got some support, some connection with others going through something similar.
And I just say that because I don't know if we've had a lot of practice with that particular meditation practice. We may have only like had one or two tastes of it in our time together. So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, and maybe just on that note, or the Tonglen, giving and taking, I mean, in my experience, there's no more effective practice for really swapping this sense that we're being done in by suffering from actually feeling like, oh, the heart is opening because of the suffering. So I highly recommend it. It's right. It's one of the methods we have to change the way we navigate our lives.
Maybe there'll be time at the end of class for a little taste of that.
Sure, absolutely. Happy to. Maybe I'll just say briefly, because what's coming up in the next teaching, Nurture the Three Principal Roots, Wise Aspiration, Pure Devotion, Full Preparation. I mean, the translation is, I'm not sure, but in the way I learned this teaching is getting at the importance of having our sources of refuge, right? Our spiritual friends, right? So the three principal roots would be the spiritual friend, and to, I mean, this again is getting back to how relational we are, that we can just read the words and we can try to, you know, memorize these teachings, but we really do need people to help us along, right? We need our teachers who inspire us, right? We need our spiritual friends to help us really stay the course and understand more deeply what we're practicing. And then we need the spiritual instructions, right? It's so wonderful that you have Nalanda, where you can unpack these teachings, think about them, chew on them, again, so that they're more likely to get deeply rooted in the mind. And then we need supportive environment, right? We need environments where people will appeal to our, I would say, our Buddha nature, where people will reflect our ability to be intelligent and skillful and patient and reflective. Right. I mean, these are critically important resources. And then the next part, cultivate the three things tirelessly, you know, is to really trust. We need our spiritual friend, right? So it's sometimes translated as a interested humility toward our spiritual friend, and a joy in our practice, right? That's very important, so that it doesn't feel like drudgery, doesn't feel like something we should do. We'd be less neurotic if we practiced, we'd be a better neighbor, but to really start to cultivate a sense of devotion, joyful devotion, that this is a way to be in the world. And what a time, right? What a time when the more suffering there is, the more opportunity there is to really arrive with genuine compassion and courage and determination. So we need that sense of joy. But in order to get there, we also need the commitment, right? So that it doesn't become something that we're curious about, but I don't know, you know, there's other methodologies out there, tried intermittently. I mean, you know the drill. With anything that has actually been meaningful for you, it is required depth of commitment. Whether it's relationship to a friend or to a child or to your creativity, nothing happens of real merit without that depth of commitment. So the commitment will help you cultivate the joy, which will help you stay the course. And this gets back to Joe's point that with Lojong, there's an opportunity to have a kind of monastic experience. We're gonna read this, we're gonna study this, we're gonna memorize it so that we can bring it out into the world, into our lives. All right, any other questions or comments before we do a little bit of practice? I think I was seeing Joe, go ahead.
No, I'm just, actually I was checking on some of the chats. Are you noticing some of the chat comments?
I haven't noticed the chats, no. I haven't learned yet with Zoom how to divide my attention between the chat and the live interaction.
Oh. Krista was sharing that the teaching trusts our Buddha nature, and that's different from a kind of cerebral motivation to consciously achieve. You're running out of power?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that this, to me, the thing that, we talked a little bit about before you came, Pilar, we were talking about the different flavors of the Dharma practice and monasticism in relation to more of a lay-oriented, in relation to more of a tantric kind of spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think that this really, it is interesting. This teaching has such a unique flavor, mm-hmm. because there is something about it that's so monastic in the sense of being so serious. Mm-hmm. Right, there's a level of like, whoa, and yet at the same time, there's you know, it's really very much about being in the world, about everyday life, about simple folksy kind of secret teachings that you might get, and there's even a transformational kind of approach. There's a kind of a tantric approach to it about that you described the alchemical quality of the notion of really transforming. So, but to me, the thing about this practice is that, you know, I think about this as somebody who was raised as a Catholic. Well, you know, as a Catholic, you either become a monk or a priest or something, and then you can really practice, you know. But if you're a lay person, you just, you know, you kind of go, you know, hang out, go to church, get some wafers and stuff like that, you know. And what I think about this, it's such a small little teaching that it offers a roadmap for very serious commitment to compassion, to cultivating compassion.
Yeah.
You know, and with a very high standard, but also at the same time accessible. And that the sort of telling of it, the sort of telling point is that there's this set of commitments and pledges. Mm-hmm. Sort of give it this kind of, I don't know, binding feeling or whatever, this kind of like, yeah, you do that, really, you got to do this. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think it just feels very, I think maybe it's part of the reason why it's so popular in Tibetan culture, mm-hmm. that it really does distill so much of oceans of centuries of Buddhist philosophy and ethics and psychology into this just three pages. And, you know, so it's really quite a remarkable practice.
It really is. The depth, the breadth, and yet, these are pithy teachings. Yeah. So, yeah, I just want to check to see. I imagine, I know it's getting late, so some of you might be just feeling the weightiness of a long day, but wondering if this is landing or stirring any other questions before we do a few minutes of practice. I would also just say, I mean, it's important to be inspired, right? It's important to really feel that you've got teachings to work with that can generate extraordinary meaning. And to feel the sense of possibility and to develop the commitment. But also I think it's equally important to not be discouraged, right? Because this is a challenging process of cultivating the ability to be in the world, to go through radical changes, to live with so many levels of uncertainty. So I'd like to just offer that balance, right, of deep devotion alongside some flexibility when it's difficult or if you experience doubt, and to not worry too much about that. Right, to just keep learning, keep practicing, see how it feels, see what you notice. And there's another teaching in here about just checking to see, right? It's part of the investigating and the analyzing, to just check in with yourself to see what's working, what could be nurtured, you know, what's maybe not getting as much traction, and good to be curious about that.
Can I ask a question in that regard?
Sure.
So we think about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And for me, I totally agree with co-creation, and we do this all the time. And so for me, I thrive in a Sangha. And there are so many challenges in Sanghas these days. Mm-hmm. And so it's the... And I have lost my Sangha as a result of the Me Too movement. And I'm really grieving that. And so I do find it hard to maintain the commitment, the connection, and to thrive without a Sangha. And in the Nundro practice that I've done, you know, we talk about a Sangha as companions on the way. So yes, we are alone, but We also live within a sangha, and I'm kind of stuck. And so you know, you're kind of straddling this boundary between what we do alone and what we do in community. And I'm kind of just going to let it hang there and ask you if you have any thoughts.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Yeah. I mean, in my experience, it is extremely tough to feel genuinely in connection to spiritual practice without the simultaneous genuine connection to Sangha. There's a reason why it's one of the three jewels. But there are times when we might find ourselves more on our own for a variety of reasons. And this is certainly a time when, you know, many people are feeling without sufficient support, without sufficient sense of community. And it can start to generate the feelings of aloneness, right? That the Dharma is all about challenging. So I guess I would say to use that experience as part of your compassion practice, right? This can be an object of your Tonglen practice. This is not easy to feel without sufficient community support, but to simultaneously be curious about how that might change. Right. I mean, one of the silver linings now is it's easier to explore communities that are geographically far from us, and to discover, you know, teachers and various meditation groups that we wouldn't otherwise, and see if that helps at all. But if it doesn't, or even until such time that it does, to let your experience be met with some tenderness, some compassion.